Hello, everyone. Welcome. This episode, before we get started, I do want to say we'll be triggering to some of you, whether anything has happened to you or someone you know. We will be discussing things relating to sexual abuse, physical abuse, and kind of just accountability as we see it today. As you guys know, we just witnessed Surviving R. Kelly, which was a docuseries, a 6-part on Lifetime, where we kind of got to view the life of a predator. And we listened to victim stories. We listened to people who were there. I do want to preface by also saying that this episode will not be an entire recount of that docuseries, Surviving R. Kelly. But I want to say that this is going to be more so surviving society. There was a lot of larger picture items that were brought to us in that documentary. And whether you were on Instagram, social media, group chats with your friends, phone calls about this after the fact, you know that all of the things that got brought to light were things that we deal with in our families, with our friends, at school, at work, and definitely things that we all have to come to face as a generation, as a society, as a community, as a family, as a village. And it's going to be up to us to not only start the conversation, but also to go ahead and see where we can make change. So I am sitting in this beautiful studio with some wonderful Black strong women who have not only gone through some of the things that were mentioned in the documentary, but also with women who are trying to make change and trying to shift the narrative and what we have been faced with over centuries at this point. So I guess at this point, let's go ahead and introduce who is sharing the mics with myself. And let's start off to the right. Who do I have?
I am Jade, Jade of All Jays Online. I am half host of Getting Grown, half host of Jaden XD.
Yes.
Mommy to Noah, wife to Tristan. A real nigga.
Awesome. And across from me, we have...
Hi. You're listening to your most unapologetic sexologist. I like to really get that out there because I don't believe I need to apologize for what is right. Michelle Hope. So I'm in the house. I'm going to give you some insight on education, as I've been in education for over 20 years. Been speaking on sex and sexuality for the past 10 years. And I'm really, really passionate about reproductive justice. I think sometimes when people hear, oh, you're a sexpert, they think dick and pussy, which I can do. I can pop it. I can drop it. But what my passion really is creating equity for women and girls of color. But in addition to that, really looking at sexuality from a holistic perspective.
Yes.
And understanding that as much as we need to teach our women and grow our women, we must do the same for our young men. And we have to really be looking out for everybody. And really, it's going to be some tough conversations happening today, I feel like.
No, absolutely.
Yeah. Challenging the norms.
Absolutely. We'll be joined a little later on with Jamila Lemieux. And I want her to introduce herself as she sees fit. As you guys know, this is your girl, Mandy. I am one half co-host of the Horrible Decisions podcast. And so we focus on sexual liberation, as you guys know, but also just bringing forth these conversations that are needed in a healthy sexual environment. And so I wanted, I guess, to start off, we can kind of say we did all watch the documentary. Mm-hmm. So do you guys want to let's do a broad review of what we thought of the documentary before we touch into the specific topics that stemmed from Surviving R. Kelly. So what was your immediate interaction? You did see a good amount of the 6 parts. So what was your immediate reaction to that?
The ghetto. The ghetto was, like, not to make light of the documentary, but I mean, nigga, like, we... You know, this has been a long time coming.
Yeah.
I remember when the tape dropped. I remember when it circulated. I remember when coworkers were passing it around. Yeah. I remember when high school students were passing it around. So, like, I remember when the Aaliyah shit happened. I remember being a young girl talking to my mom, like, yo, ma, like, this is not right.
You knew it wasn't right.
Oh, hell yeah. I'm 15 and a grown man. I was like, married, ma? That don't sound right. Like, that's not right. So right. I remember all of that. But watching it in detail was the ghetto.
And so I'm so glad that we will have kind of a wide range of even ages between all of us, because I was watching this, and when I'm seeing that these accounts were happening in 98, 99, 2000, I'm a millennial, so I was 10, 11, 12, maybe 14 when the trial happened. Mm-hmm. Or so, like, watching this, I didn't have those emotional connections to seeing what was going on. I just knew I was stepping in the name of love in middle school at the dances. Remix to Ignition, all of that. I was here for R. Kelly. Yeah. Although I knew of the Aaliyah thing. Aaliyah died. I was in fifth grade. Mm-hmm. So those connections and knowing what was really going on in the media didn't affect me as a fan of his growing up, nor did I really have, I guess, the mental capacity to know what the fuck was going on. And how about you? What were your thoughts? Because you knew.
I grew up in Indiana.
Hearing about it, though.
He was on the radio all the time. It was like the everything. But I can't honestly say, when AJ Nothing But a Number came out, I was in middle school, right? I'm dating myself. I was like, now I know what that song's about, and that is not right.
That's not right.
I knew. I mean,
right.
I come from maybe a different background. My mom was really open, mm-hmm. And taught me about sexuality. I learned about sexuality from a very, very young age. Mm-hmm. I experienced molestation at a young age. And to be quite frank with you, like, I knew at 14 that what that song meant, going down. I knew what going down ain't nothing but a thing meant. This love that I have for you, it will never change. Like, I knew that was already predatorial. But here's the thing. It didn't really faze me.
Nope, I was a bop.
Like, I mean, was, yeah, you know,
hit
off from the bed, pulled around. I knew all that was creepy and predatorial then, but I didn't know the gravity of what was happening behind closed doors. I think we all thought, he's just a freaking nasty freaky freak.
We thought he was a freak.
Girl, I remember, because I was big into English and like all of that. And I was like, you remind me. He is speaking about women like nouns.
Exactly. Like, I just taught that on Friday.
I didn't think that.
Like objects. Yeah. You remind me of my Jeep. I want to wax it. Something like my sound. An object. An inanimate object at that.
Yes.
He was telling us, listen, I don't see nothing wrong. My mind's telling me no. My body's telling me
what
yes.
What is that? Yeah. What is that?
And then was the inanimate object sound. Then was Aaliyah, AJ, nothing but a number.
Like, seeing the documentary, it was just telling.
I was like, we knew this. I was really frustrated.
You know why I was frustrated? Because you touched on it beforehand when we were talking before we started. I was frustrated with myself. And I had to sit there and say, yo.
Why?
When did I stop listening to R. Kelly after I already knew his history?
I'll sit here. Like,
I had to think about it.
I really loved the song with him and Sparkle, and it played. I can't remember where. And I downloaded it to my iTunes. This had to have been maybe 6 months ago. And so to know that I, too, was still also supporting this man after knowing the things he did.
No.
And I'm an adult now. I'm approaching 30. But to know that we had all the insight of the world of what has been happening. 2017, the cult situation, which was episode 5 and 6, we all just revisited this in 2017, and to know he's still out here touring. He's still out here having shows.
Which I think is filthy, but I remember going to work. I remember when Trapped in the Closet dropped. I remember when Ignition dropped. I remember when Ignition Remix dropped. I remember 12 Play. I didn't have no business listening to it, but I did. But I remember going to work, and on the morning show, every morning, Trapped in the Closet would drop a new
chapter.
Episode or whatever. Yeah, chapter. Yeah. And I would sit in my car and be like, I'm not the fuck getting out until I hear this ridiculous ass shit. It was so entertaining.
It was.
And then I know there was a shift somewhere there where I was like, I can't listen to this nigga's music anymore. Yeah. But I don't know where it was.
I can tell you exactly where mine was.
Okay.
So 2012, Trapped in the Closet had come out. It was the independent film channel here in New York, did all 33 of them in one sitting.
Mm-hmm.
It was beautiful art. And I know some people personally who were a part of that project and were very integral parts of that project. And they fell in love, and they have a beautiful family, and we've been friends, and I've known them for quite some time.
Mm-hmm.
And so they said, hey, come check this out. They were not a part of R. Kelly's camp. They were just a part of that production.
Mm-hmm.
I want to make that very clear.
Mm-hmm.
So I went, and then there was an after party afterwards. Now, me being the sexual researcher that I am, I'm enthralled. I'm like, this man, for years, we've heard these rumors that he's into young women. He's, you know, this, that, and the other. And I was there. I was looking good. I was at the after party. And one of his handlers came over to me and said, Mr. Kelly would like to talk to you.
How old were you then?
29.
Okay.
And now I have lived a lot of life. I mentioned that to you. So I'm 29 years old. I'd already started studying psychology. I'd already started studying sex research. I had already done my fair share of participatory research. And I felt like this was a great opportunity just to talk to this man. And why would he want to talk to me? I'm a 29-year-old woman. And this, I think, is interesting because it points out how anybody can be a victim.
Yes.
It's not just about young women.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And we chatted for a moment. He gave me his number. And then he started texting me. You know, I'm not thinking nothing about it. This is not the first celebrity. It's hopefully not going to be the last. And then I got a text from him and said, call me daddy. Bish. I said, bloop, 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 delete, bloop, 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 block. And I was like, oh, wow. And that was I have not listened to R. Kelly music since.
Well, so him wanting you to...
Because it was just literally, I had seen all these things happen throughout history. And then when the devil is staring you in your face, and you think it's not going to happen to me. And as soon as I saw a text message that said, call me daddy, I was done.
He was about to start grooming
you.
But I see, I get goose pimples thinking about that.
All-Star Chicago. There was an All-Star weekend in Chicago. My little sister went out there, and I think she was 16. And she called me and my mom, and she was like, I'm standing next to R. Kelly. My mother said, move now.
Exactly.
Move immediately. Walk away. And I was like, this ain't no game. Now, he didn't try to talk to her. It's nothing that personal. But it's interesting. I had an experience. It wasn't no call me daddy, and it wasn't definite. It wasn't that nigga. But... I got backstage at a Kanye West concert when I was 18. Got myself backstage. Ironically enough, at the door, they checked everybody's IDs and said verbatim, we don't want no R. Kelly stuff. But I'm 18.
Right.
So that's where this fine line, we can have that conversation.
Right,
later.
Right. And it's crazy because I have a friend now who is currently dealing with R. Kelly. And so I text her in our group chat, and I was like, what are your thoughts about this? Because we actually had a group chat conversation when all the culty stuff came out. And it really hurts my soul. Her response was blaming the parents and blaming the other girls knowing what they were doing. So this is a conversation that we're now having because she, too, is sticking up for him, just posted that he is the king of R&B on her Instagram. And I don't view her as a weak woman.
I know.
And so to know that I do have a friend, and she is a very close friend of mine, who she flies out to Chicago. She's been to Chicago. She goes to his shows. She is grown. She is over 30. But when we tried to have this conversation with her about what's going on, she definitely pointed the fingers around him and not at him. And so seeing where her response was, I did go ahead and just kind of shy away from the conversation. I'm going to let it, you know, fall down a little. She hasn't seen all of the documentary yet, but she did say that she does want to talk about it. And so I will say, knowing that you have an experience with him, someone close has been around him, although this is a celebrity and we're looking at him as this god or why he can't be touched, or you would be surprised how accessible this man has been over these generations. As we saw in the documentary, he met a woman outside of his trial.
Hello.
Yo.
But I think that right there is a great segue to get us off R. Kelly and recognize that there is an R. Kelly in every fucking neighborhood across the nation.
In every household.
All up and through the industry.
And a lot of times in every household.
Yeah. I want to start off, as you guys know, they started off the documentary with discussing his childhood, the fact that he was abused. And so I do want to start off with more so the adolescence and teenage phases, where we stand at that time, how we're viewed at that time. But I want to get into something that I think is very important in saying that a lot of men, unfortunately, do not know that they have been abused or do not come forward when they have been abused. Mm-hmm. I will say if I have 10 men in my phone, at least 8 of them have opened up about being sexually abused mm-hmm. as children. And this has come in the form of either being touched by other men, but more so the babysitter, the mom's friend, the yeah. older woman in the family, they all lost their virginity to older women. And because of how we view sexuality when it comes to men, they didn't look at it as they were being molested or raped or abused. They looked at it like, I'm the man. I lost my manhood by an older woman. And I don't think that that's a narrative that should continue. I guess, do you want to go into some of what you have experienced being 10 years in abuse and working with children, mm-hmm. what you see is coming about from why men respond this way?
Well, I think that in my professional experience, what I have seen is gender. When we think about sexuality, we think about gender. And gender is a construct. Gender, we have associated it with biologically assigned sex, but gender is a construct. And the longer that we continue to separate genders and really establish rigid ideals around what makes a man mm-hmm. and what makes a woman, instead of looking at us as humans, mm. right? Humans have needs. They need to be loved. They need to feel like they are appreciated. They are cared for. They need shelter. They need food. They need water. This is a human thing. But oftentimes we use gender to oppress. The social construct of gender is really rooted in oppression. So mm. if a man can say he's over a woman, mm-hmm. he then can oppress her and reign power over her. So men don't want to have their manhood removed mm. because then that makes them feel as though they have lost some type of social power. Mm. When it comes to communities of color, men of color are already on a lower ring. We think about the matrix of oppression, right? Mm-hmm. Who is at the top? White men. So when we think of men of color, they're down a peg. So for them, and they're often trying to prove their manhood.
Mm-hmm. Yes, they are.
In an oppressive environment, in an environment that just oppresses them for being who they are mm-hmm. as men, and does not allow them, for fear of being taken advantage of, to show weakness. Mm. So by admitting you've been sexually assaulted, admits that you have had someone take away power from you mm-hmm. in the most rawest part of humanity, sex, the part of humanity that connects all of us, sex.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So if a man has something from his sexual prowess or sexual power taken from him, society will really shame him. Mm-hmm. So instead of allowing a man to process pain, to have a safe space to say, this happened to me, we say, you better buck up, because that's not what a man does. Mm-hmm. And then we start that programming. You know, we talk about how the police oftentimes age up our men. Mm-hmm. We did that before they did.
We do it all the time. Mm.
Stop crying. Mm. Man up. Mm-hmm. That is setting the basis for toxic masculinity.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
A healthy man can cry because a healthy human has feelings. We have to separate. If a woman didn't cry, we'd be like, she's fucked up, an
right.
ice princess.
Right, yeah.
But if men don't cry, we say, oh, he's manly. That is a sick idea of human connection mm-hmm. because we cannot truly have empathy if right. we cannot feel. Right. If you cannot feel pain, you cannot understand the pain you are putting on someone else.
Right.
If you tell an 11-year-old boy, you weren't raped, you became a man, how then do you expect him to understand at 21 when he raped another woman?
Right.
Because no, girl, you didn't get raped. Yep. You got lucky because I'm the shit. I'm that man. And we have to get away from these ideals
yes.
Because it just further divides us.
I agree. And it's crazy because if you sit here and think of what you were just saying, the man up, toughen up, don't cry, you know, at these young ages from 5 to 10, you're sitting here grooming a little boy to be a man.
Mm-hmm.
And so imagine if they're being taught those things, they're not going to come forward about their power because now they're trying to prove to their parents. They're trying to prove to their uncles, I'm a man, I'm a man, I'm a man, which is why even with the Terry Crews situation, him coming out, seeing the response from other men, that
and women.
There was and women.
Oh, yes.
That's
and
a
women.
Huge problem.
No, it is. It is. And I don't want to make this episode even. I know we do have a lot of men that listen. I don't want this or for you guys to think that we are man bashing. There is accountability that also needs to be taken with
this
women.
Is about mentality.
I'm not a man.
Okay.
Yes.
I just
want to
be sure.
Know.
I already know, but it could come off that way when we start to talk about rape and abuse, and we don't want it to. As women, I do want to say that there is a shared part that we have to do as parents, teaching the young girls the same way we do our boys.
Well, I think it's teaching our boys the same way we do
our girls.
I think it's language is really important in this conversation. So if you catch me at some point backing up because I misspoke, I want to be very, very, very careful with language. And we'll talk about that a little bit later, I think, because I want to later on when Jamila gets here, I want to talk about the word pedophile. Because that is not exactly what we're seeing with R. Kelly. And I want to give you guys the definition.
Well, we're discussing children right now. And I guess if we're going to
pedophile
discuss,
is under 12.
So let's discuss the terms. I would like to do that now, since what we're going to be doing for the next like 15 or 20 minutes or so is definitely digging into the psychology of children, how we view children, our expectations of children.
Yeah.
And so what if a pedophile is a
prepubescent,
someone who is attracted or deals with someone under the age of 12.
Yes.
What would be considered someone who deals with individuals older than the age of 12?
Okay, so there's three kind of phases, right? Mm-hmm. So there's pedophile. I'm going to struggle with this, so you might have to retake this. Herbophile?
Mm-hmm. Herbophile, okay.
Yes, which is H-E-B-P-H-I-A-L-L-A.
One L.
Yes.
I think one.
I feel you. Herbophile. Okay. And then there is an E-philophite.
An E-philophite.
We're going to retake that.
But, okay, gotcha.
So the ages are a prepubescent is a pedophile. Then the second one is reaching into adolescence. So you're just kind of approaching.
So
you're like 11 to 14.
Oh, 11 to 14.
Then
The
last one is like 15 to 19. Mm-hmm. And that is a E-philophite. Mm-hmm. But the reason I want to pay attention to that is 15 to 19, we put those women in magazines all the time.
Yes.
We use that as marketing.
I was in magazines at 18.
Or Kylie Jenner, or some of these girls who end up Victoria's Secret models or bikini models. These women are 15 to 19 years old. Mm-hmm. And to be quite frank, when you look at what R. Kelly did, they were not prepubescent girls. Okay, they were that age. He's like a borderline between the two. And like the 12, 13, that's right at pubescence all the way to like 19 when he was caught saying, when you're talking about teenagers, how old you're talking, which a lot of people thought was really fucked up, and it was a fucked up thing to say.
But
when you start thinking about how our society glorifies youth and beauty. Now let's talk about being humans, and let's talk about animalistic, and let's talk about Egypt and the back in the day. It's because you are most fertile from like 15 to 25. That was the marrying age.
Age in a lot of countries now.
That's what I'm saying.
Still, yes.
They're tying that to fertility.
And reproduction.
And they're tying that to the most basic, like, lowest level of human. Mm-hmm. What we are trying to do right now is dissect at a very high thinking level. Mm-hmm. Humans are savages. Okay?
No,
all we want to do is keep our species going. And so, inertly, there's this thing. We market young women. We sell the ideas of young women. Think about the runways, the outfits.
Yeah.
And this is not blaming the woman. I am talking about society.
So when you sat here and said this is not about blaming the woman, you were on Twitter very actively, the same way like I was. Mm-hmm. And so one thing that I saw a lot of men point out, and if we want to bring this back into maybe the accountability of women or teenagers, if you can even hold them accountable, would be the girls in the club, 21 and up clubs, but with the fake IDs. The girls lying about their age, the girls going to maybe college parties while they're in high school. And I will sit here and admit, I did all three,
absolutely,
all four. I was talking to men that I probably shouldn't have. I was in the club with fake IDs. I was going to college parties as a high schooler underage. Mm-hmm. I was talking to grown men thinking I was cool because they had cars and they had their own apartments while I was in high school.
And that's where the conversation starts, where we have to talk to our young girls and our young boys and our young girls very early about what's appropriate and what's not appropriate.
And right. So
and
when you
kind
have...
of start to ingrain some of those things in them so that their conscience can, because my mom was like wild. Like my mom, I wasn't the way you said your mom was very open and so forth. My mother was the opposite.
Okay.
She was very graphic in the sense where she would be like, yo, if anybody ever tries to get you in their car, don't you ever go in their car. The things that they're going to do to you after they take you away are going to be much worse than them shooting you on spot. Like, yo, she was wild with it.
It came
from a place of trauma.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I believe. You know what I'm saying? And it came
Did she ever open up to you about anything?
Never.
Okay.
And
you know
see,
what
that's
I'm saying?
The sad thing. Yeah. Sometimes I wish we would.
Yeah. But she didn't. And it perpetuates a cycle opening up.
I have a question. You started by saying that you're a wife, you're a mother. Mm-hmm. Have you experienced any sort of sexual trauma?
I have. I was molested at a young age.
Okay.
And then sexually assaulted as an adult. And also, that's why these conversations, it's so interesting to see people's commentary like, she's a fast-ass little girl. You know what I'm saying?
That's where I was getting at with that conversation.
But then we'll have, when we're young, we're always trying to be older. We do silly shit in the name of like trying to be mature.
But that is actually a part of the adolescent brain.
That is part of that, exactly.
I think it's so crazy that we are a perfect storm of opportunity when you end up with someone, a predator.
Yes.
Whether R. Kelly or
a family
uncle,
member or anyone, a teacher, anyone.
Right. Mm-hmm. Anybody. Mm-hmm. Because in adolescence, prepubescence and adolescence, you have so many things going on. Your hormones are raging. You're having all these feelings you cannot explain. Your brain, actually, the adolescent brain takes 80 seconds to recognize it's made a bad decision. If we were to sit here for 80 seconds, I do this exercise in my classes. I sit in silence for 80 seconds and I say, how many other bad decisions can you make
in 80 seconds?
In 80 seconds, because they just start compiling. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, we have to really, as parents, we have to really educate ourselves on how adolescence works, mm-hmm. because there's a reason for the rebellion. There's a reason for it's never going to happen to me.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk about that for sure.
Developmental stuff.
Yes.
And mm-hmm. parents think, I don't want to talk too soon. Guess when too soon is? Never. How about I teach? I also do a parenting class mm-hmm. for 0 to 3 early sexual development in children. Mm-hmm. You should start building body autonomy before that child can speak, because language is important.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
We know statistically Black children go into kindergarten 50,000 words less than their white counterparts on average.
Mm-hmm.
But guess what that means? That means that we are missing out on opportunities to create body autonomy in them in mm-hmm. some of those 50,000 words they don't have. No. Bottom. Vagina. It's not a hoo-ha.
It's not a fucking cupcake. It's not a bagel.
Please, parents,
it is a vagina and it's a penis.
And a penis.
And I teach my daughter, and we could talk about this more when Jamila joins us, because she also has a daughter the same age. But we teach our daughter very much and have taught her very early about privacy.
Yes.
About people not, if you don't want to be touched, if you don't want to be hugged, mm-hmm. then you don't have to be hugged.
Right.
You are more than welcome to tell this person, I don't want to be touched.
Great. I like that. Well, we're going to go ahead. We're going to take a break. And when we get back, we will have Jamila Lemieux joining us. So we'll be right back. Hi, guys. We are back and we are plus one. We are now joined with Jamila Lemieux. And I don't think I could do justice of saying everything that you do. So please let everyone know what it is that you do.
You know, it's funny. That's how my family feels, too. They're like, you have a job?
Are you sure?
I'm like, I do. I have a lot of jobs. I'm a cultural critic and writer. I was an editor at Ebony Magazine for many years. And then I was over at Interactive One as a programming VP. And now I'm working for myself. I've got some consulting clients. The primary one is Girls for Gender Equity, which is an organization, a nonprofit that works with girls, gender nonconforming, and trans youth between the ages of 14 and 25 on policy work, mentoring, survivor circles for survivors of sexual violence. And I guess in my role as cultural critic, I did appear in Surviving R. Kelly as a commentator.
Okay. And you did a great job, by the way.
Thank you.
You was bringing some truth to it. So before we left off, we were discussing pretty much the conversation that needs to be had in the household with adolescent children, not only on how on privacy, not only on words and what to name your body parts and private parts, but also with communication. Mm-hmm. So before we left off, I did want to ask, with you saying that you have been a victim of sexual assault at a very young age, you said 11 years old, and as an adult, is this a conversation that you will have? And you have a daughter, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Is this a conversation that you will have with her, and how do you have that conversation?
Yeah, I'm gonna.
And I want to ask you as well, Jamila.
I'm gonna have to have that conversation with her only because I'm recognizing where the lack of conversation with my mother has played a huge role in how I communicate and how I talk about things and how it comes back up later on. So I'm literally, and let me be very clear. I had a very wonderful Black mother.
Mm-hmm.
But I had a very Black mother, you know what I'm saying? With
yes.
a lot of, you know, a lot of those generational things that we need to break that come along with
yes.
that. And so she was a wonderful mother, but there are things that I definitely, and I speak very openly about it on Getting Grown, that I'd like to change in how I raise my daughter. Mm-hmm. I don't ever want her to feel ashamed for anything that I don't want anything to ever happen to her. Let's
of
be
course.
Very clear.
I think that's.
But I don't ever want her to feel ashamed for things that go on with her body. For I don't ever need her to feel ashamed to come talk to me about anything. I didn't want to talk to my mother. Sorry, guys, about the very first yeast infection I had that came as a result of antibiotics.
I shared on my show, and so I'm biracial. I grew up with a white mom, but everyone jokes and says she's blacker than I am because she's that type of woman. But I hid my period from her. For a year, I was sneaking pads. I was asking friends at school just because I didn't know how to communicate that with my body at 10 years old. I was in fifth grade. I hid my period from her. And it wasn't until she was doing my laundry and saw bloody panties that she came to me and was like, when did this start?
Mm-hmm.
And that, too, was because she had never opened up. She did grow up. She was sexually assaulted. She left her house at 15 years old.
Mm-hmm.
She had to grow up very fast. And there's still, to this day, now that you mention this, she lets me know that bad things happened to her, but what it was, I
yes,
still don't
exactly.
know.
Yeah. Same.
I still
yeah.
don't know. She let me know that it wasn't easy. There were people that touched her. She was running from a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess between 0 and 10, I never felt that connection to even tell her I was on my period.
Mm-hmm.
So I definitely think even now my relationship with her, and even, oh my God, I'm getting choked up even talking about it, because now I'm realizing that there are so many things that my mom hasn't shared to me,
mm-hmm.
and I wasn't assaulted until I was an adult, but even my reaction when that happened, I feel like could have been different had this been a more open dialogue. Now, Jamila, you also have a daughter?
Yes.
What is the will you have that conversation? How are you having the conversation? Because your daughter currently is...
She's 5 and a half.
Five and
so
a half
she's
years
just
old.
A few months older mm-hmm. than...
We were
than,
pregnant together.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay, and so
our
this,
children are birds of the same feather.
They are. Two little wild birds.
Two very wild birds.
And so is this a conversation? Have you had a sex talk with her? The body talk?
Yeah.
Maybe... The privacy talk, like, how is that conversation?
It's definitely begun. It's interesting, and listening to both of your podcasts and hearing you all talk about your experiences with your mothers, I say that my mother, and even me to some extent, are somewhere square in the middle,
mm-hmm.
like a lot of classic Black mama stuff,
mm-hmm.
you know, like hiding these things or just kind of like dancing around certain subjects, you know, to protect you or perhaps mm-hmm. to protect herself. And then also kind of what people joke about is like permissive, like white, you know, white stroller parents, you know, like, and I know I'm that sometimes. I know other Black moms see me on the street like, wow, you just gonna let her, you're not gonna beat your child?
Yo, I'm not even gonna lie. Right. I rolled up on Jamila at Target one day. And Vinnie Mila was laid the fuck out like a snow angel. But
like,
it's like, you know what? What you gonna do?
Like,
I'm not gonna fight you.
I'm not gonna fight
right.
you.
But I would say that is completely different. I was just talking to Michelle the other day. I have a friend who has a 13-year-old daughter, and she just caught her daughter reading soft porn. So it was...
I was excited about it.
Yeah.
I was like, she's reading.
It's
focused
that
on
was
the
her
good
response.
Thing.
Yeah, yeah. And my friend's immediate response when she saw that her daughter was reading this was, I'm taking her laptop away. I'm putting her on punishment. And I said, ma'am, no the fuck you're not.
Yeah.
On the phone with my friend, I said, ma'am, Don't punish her for stuff that we know is going to happen. I said, you don't think she's just going to go read that shit on the school computers?
Right.
I said, so, and I'm not even a parent. I ain't got no kids. I ain't shot nothing out my vagina. But I do know the importance of those conversations, knowing I wish I had those conversations.
Right. Yeah.
And I'm a very sexual person, as a lot of you know. You grew up differently.
I did. So I did. Okay, so my mom is a lesbian, and she's white, and she was a feminist. And we had to have a conversation about racism a couple years ago, because she's a white feminist. Yeah. So we had to.
Yeah, we get it.
No, but I have to really applaud her, because when we had that conversation, she sat on boards. She's like, you ladies, but she was a white woman in Indiana. And she kind of disclosed to me, black women kept saying they needed their own. And we kept saying, no, we're all fighting the same fight. Mm-hmm. And she was like, Michelle, it took you to like teach me that it's not the same fight. But I am super grateful that I grew up in this space. Like, I always tell people, you got to go to Camp Onawanapia. I went to Lilith Fair before there was Lilith Fair. Mm-hmm. And I'll never forget watching a woman lay on the floor and breathe, do breathing exercises into an orgasm. I was probably your daughter's age.
Yeah.
5 or 6.
Oh, wow.
And I remember being like, Mom, what is she doing? And my mom was just like, she is pleasing herself without touching her genitals. And this is a very natural part of being a human. And I know sometimes you might get urges to touch your vagina, but you can't do that in public. And this woman is just demonstrating how to feel pleasure without touch. Yeah, and like she was like, and my mom loves to tell the stories how I was like a chronic masturbator. I want to be very, very clear. That is a very normal behavior in sexual development. And oftentimes when I do parent classes, I hear parents say they chastise their children and they yell at their children and they're like, don't do that. And that is the best way to open them up to a predator.
Yeah.
Because if you are chastising them for doing something very natural.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Did you know baby boys can be seen masturbating in the womb?
In vitro.
No way.
Yeah. Because to them, it's not sexual. To them, it's body exploration, and they touch a part of their body like, man, this feels good. At that age, between the ages of like infancy to like 5 and 6, it is not for a purpose of orgasm. It is. It's like sucking your thumb. Well, and this feels good. That's why you see it at nap time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's why you see it at bedtime.
That's why boys
really
always
yeah. When I was
balls.
In preschool, that was like a thing.
Yep.
You know. And so I'll say my mother, I think, had a very good approach to it. And I won't talk about my child and if she's done or but just that our approach to that is similar. So if that's something that we were to catch her, doing, it's one. Of course, we have to talk about dirty kid hands.
Yeah.
And what that can cause down there.
Right.
But that exploring that part of her body is natural.
It is.
It's really just, okay, you can't do this when you're on the playground with your friends.
Right.
You can't do this
at school.
But I also don't want to create shame around that part of her body so that when somebody unlocks that button, this thing that she's been curious about, now that she's, she'll be vulnerable to them. I'll just say, to your question about how I talked to her about predators and sex in general, I think we've had a very progressive, as did my parents. Like, I knew body part names. So even though we might have said pocketbook, or I think it was private area or private became privacy, or, I have an itch in my private area or my privacy. When I was a little kid, I still knew vagina and penis. And she has a younger brother and they bathe together. So she's seen a penis.
Yeah.
She's, clear that they have different equipment. And she's not terribly curious about it, but like curious enough, it's like, okay, he's got this thing, I've got that thing.
Right.
I'm not hiding it much from her.
Right.
She saw the beginning of the R. Kelly documentary. I wasn't, going to let her sit through all of it.
But
she was getting ready to go to bed. I let her get a glimpse of mommy on TV. That's something that's always exciting to her. And it's funny because she said, so when did R. Kelly die? And I was like, well, he didn't die.
Valid
and
question.
He didn't die. And she said, ugh.
Valid
mood.
Well,
he just needs to go.
Mood.
Right, there you
because
go.
Because I told her once we were in a store, and they were playing one of his songs on the radio. It might have been I Believe I Can Fly or Ignition, something I knew that she would hear again. And my daughter loves music. She loves old school music. Mm-hmm. And I said, you must know that this is a bad man.
Yeah.
When you hear his music, you don't dance. And she said, why is he a bad man? I said, he hurts black women and girls. you know? And so why are you in this movie about him? Why is there a movie about him? Because he's done bad things to a lot of black women and girls, and that's important. So she recognizes him as a bad person.
Like,
and the only thing we really talked about beyond that from the documentary, because she saw, I put her to bed during the Aaliyah section, you know, she asked about who Aaliyah was, and, you know, and I said, little girls do not have adult boyfriends.
Perfect.
You don't have adult friends. You know what I mean? You have my friends, because she does have a lot of play uncles and people who, you know, not, she's only met one person I was dating, and it was a serious relationship. But aside from that, you know, the men that are around are my friends.
Right.
And so, and people that I trust her with, and there's only a handful of them that she would be around them one-on-one.
Right.
You know, because I don't want to ritualize or normalize, like, you just be with men.
Yeah.
You know, these are people that, you know, a godfather, a father's best friend, my best friend. But that these are not your friends. These are mommy's friends. These are people who care about you. These are people that are part of your village. And even with that, you know, there's still a level with the women, too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, it's everyone. You know, and I ask, has anyone touched you? You know, when you're not with me, how, you know, how are you treated at school? How do you know if you need to help wipe me yourself when you were in daycare? You know, like when she was in daycare, I'd ask, you know, would so-and-so do it? How did they do it? You know, and usually they were hands off. There were times where I'm like, yo, she needs some help in the bathroom. She's coming home smelling like pee.
Yeah.
But I get it. You know, and I respect and understand the kind of fear of, like, you know, not wanting to do more than handing her a baby wipe and just standing by the door, as opposed to getting in there when she needed somebody to do it because she was three.
Right.
You know?
Well, what you say, Jade, what you've said, and Michelle, what you've said, is the education that starts in the household. And I feel like that is more so needed than anything because of the lack of sex education in schools.
Absolutely.
They're not an, I remember, and I'm class of 09, sex ed was an elective. One semester in high school, and it still pretty much was be abstinent, don't have sex, or you'll die or get pregnant.
Oh, yeah,
and there was really, it was more, we talked about it yesterday, and it was more so scare tactics.
Were you at a private school or public school?
No, I went to a public school in Orlando, Florida.
Wow. Yeah.
And
Florida, it does teach sex ed as
an
elective,
it's
even
an elective,
to this day.
Yes.
But they really push abstinence
they
only.
Push abstinence.
So they use a lot of scare tactics.
It's a lot of scare tactics involved.
And it's not accurate or inclusive.
Well, and not only that, I remember even being in sex ed, maybe half the semester was nutrition. So it was like sex ed and nutrition. Yes. So I'm just like, and it was counted as like a physical education, like a PE course. And I'm just like, when I finally got, you know, into fucking, I was like, that did absolutely nothing for me.
Yep.
It was still very much not talked about in the household. So the fact that you have began talking with your child and you do the same, I think that it's more needed with women and boys, but not pushing our men to have sex and not sitting here telling women they're
never to do
horrible sluts if they have it. Like, there has to be some sort of middle dialogue to let people know, like, we're humans. This is how it's going to happen. We pleasure ourselves. We touch ourselves. We're human beings.
Well, I think what we have to remember, and this is something we don't talk about. So for me and the work that I do, you know, I see myself as an activist, a reproductive justice activist, a social activist. But I am a firm believer, and I've said this before and I will say it. A large part of the generational poverty that black people experience is rooted in sexuality. Because sexuality touches every single part of our lives. Gender or identity, which would encompass gender and body image. Sexual reproductive health. Look at the disparities in STIs and HIV rates across the nation. Sexualization, which you guys have been talking about.
I loved the sexualization of black women specifically.
Yeah. Well, like, but not only that, here's the thing about sexualization. It's on a spectrum. So on the healthy part, you have flirting.
Right.
And how to be able to attract a mate. And on the really disgusting part, you have what we saw in the last three nights of this surviving R. Kelly. You have sensuality, which is about being okay with your body.
With yourself,
right? You have reproductive rights, which is we're starting to see chipped
birth
away
control,
from
abortion,
the Trump administration. And then you have society.
Yeah.
Because your values, your religious background, all of these things come to play. Your experience with your mother come into play. And that is what gets us to places where we see high rates of intimate partner violence. Mm-hmm. The CDC just said black women from zero to somewhere around 35. Homicide is in the top three causes of death.
Yeah.
Like, we have to understand.
Be careful saying that. I was on the Breakfast Club with someone who gave that statistic and have had to deal with 2 years of black men accusing me of being at war with black men.
Oh, no, I'm not at war with black men.
For mentioning.
I know.
That for, I want to say it's black women and girls between the ages of 14 to 25, the number two cause of death is homicide.
Yes, girl.
And by her saying that, I've had to deal with, I posted a picture of my daughter and I at the White House with Barack and Michelle Obama, and someone shared it and got hundreds of retweets with Jamila and the number two killer of black women.
Guess what? We didn't say black men were doing the killing. We said that intimate partner violence does the killing.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
right.
For all these black men who want to come for
they love to
bring it.
Yo, fuck you ashy ass niggas. I'm tired. No, I'm tired of reading all of these comments. Yes. And I try not to retweet this shit. And I see it. Mm-hmm. I see it. And I'm not fighting people with my fucking thumbs.
No. Right.
But you all choose to be, you choose blatant ignorant, like to be blatantly ignorant. They don't fucking read. They don't thoroughly read. This is black men. This is black women. This is white men. This is white. This is a whole bunch of motherfucking people who don't fucking read and don't know anything, and they spew all kinds of bullshit. They've never been through anything, or they've been through a whole bunch and they don't know how to fucking deal with it. But what they need to learn how to do is shut the fuck up. And I'm so tired of reading people spew things all over the place, and y'all don't know what the fuck you're talking about.
Well, even when it came to them saying, well, teenage girls be out here doing this and doing that. And it, the fact that I was reading this from black men, it's like, you guys want to find every way to blame us for why we're treated the way we are, why we're over-sexualized, why people don't believe us. Like, if you even look into the statistics right now of black women and their births and having births, how we're treated when we go to the doctor.
Yeah.
I've seen documentaries where they say, we just don't believe that black women really hurt as much as they say they hurt.
But that's because, like, the foundation of gynecology was built on the backs of black slave women.
Exactly. Yeah.
Like,
exactly.
The people want to talk about, oh, Tuskegee was terrible. Honey, come and sit with me for a little bit, and I'm going to show you how the American Medical Association, through reproductive health and reproductive oppression, have been killing black and brown women and then calling it medical miracles. Yep. And for these men, I'm not calling you out, brother. I'm calling you in. I am not calling you out. And I understand some of these feminist circles can be very uncomfortable.
Absolutely.
Because sometimes I go to them and I'm like, listen, ladies, we're kind of fucking
guys.
Up.
Same.
Because we're not going to get nothing done without men. But men, I need you to grab your motherfucking cojones, pull your da-dun-da-duns up, and step to the table, because we need you.
Yeah.
If you didn't see that in that video, in that show...
Right. If your reaction to anything in Surviving R. Kelly was to defend anyone other than black women and girls, we didn't watch the same movie.
No, we didn't.
And I don't care if you were disappointed and this person shouldn't have been in it, or this thing was not, you know, this part wasn't handled well. You can critique the documentary. I'm not saying it was perfect.
Right,
but if your takeaway was not black women and girls being underprotected, over-sexualized, discarded, then your heart is not in the right place. And something that you mentioned when you talk about... at the beginning of your remarks a few minutes ago, how the disparities in income and life outcomes for black people in this country, rooting back to sexuality, the preschool, we talk about the school to prison pipeline when we talk about black children in general, or specifically black boys, but for black girls, it's the sexual assault to prison pipeline often, right? So like, how do you get into the carceral system?
Right.
Like, why were you suspended from class?
Why were you
sleeping
acting out
in class? Why were you acting out? Why didn't you come with your uniform? Because something's going on at home.
Yep.
That your teachers, your white, middle-class, suburban teachers that landed in the ghetto for a few years while they're waiting for somebody to marry them so they don't have to do that kind of work anymore, so they can get a master's degree for free while they're languishing in Bed-Stuy or Harlem trying to figure things out in their 20s.
Oh,
they're dealing with these kids that they can't connect to.
Mm-hmm.
They're not recognizing that the girl who always has the attitude doesn't know how to deal with the fact that she's got a D-cup breast. And the boys are saying something about it, or just staring
at her. She don't want to run.
Doesn't feel comfortable.
She doesn't even have the right money to get the right size bra.
So she's in pain.
Yeah. And she is bubbling out.
Literally.
And then you all are making her run around the block. You're making her do all these things.
And
she is uncomfortable.
You can't sit through gym class, even though, maybe I gained a cup size and 20 pounds in the past semester, and I don't have new gym clothes.
Because
I want to sit down because I'm
And then I'm not going to eat
my pain.
Or even as maybe a more developed black woman, I will say there were clothes that I could put on, and the next girl next to me, if she was smaller, could put on, and the teachers would come to me and be like, oh, no, this is inappropriate.
Yes.
And teachers would be looking at me a certain way.
What?
I know, because of what I was wearing. And I was talking to her, just the sexualization of us looking at how things fit.
Yes.
Still 12, 13, 14-year-old girl, we're getting into puberty in certain ways. And we are feeling uncomfortable with our boobs being big. I was on the TV. This is not funny, but I was on the TV announcements when I was in school. I was the one that said, hey, welcome everyone to school. And I remember for at least a month, I would get on TV, I would have them adjust the camera, but I would sit at the table like this to have my arms cover my chest because the boys would always mention how big my breasts were on TV and how they looked. And I'm just like, I'm not comfortable with the size of my tits. So yes, what you're saying is very, very true.
Something I want to shout out that Girls for Gender Equity is doing that I think is really important. They launched at the end of last year a campaign called The School Girls Deserve, right? And so they did research. They talked to girls and queer and trans youth in New York City schools. And, you know, what are you looking for? Like, what would make this a better, safer environment for you? Dress code violations are at the top of the list of reasons that girls of color are suspended from school or miss classroom activities.
Detention, all of that.
Suspension,
My mom couldn't come and get me to change my outfit.
Right, because
so what am I supposed to
work.
Do? You're taking me out of my class because you don't like the length of my skirt, and I can sit here and point out 2, 3, 4, 5 other girls with a skirt that would be just as questionable. But because I have thighs, because I have these hips, it's looking sexualized. And I would fight that. This was me in middle school. So what you're saying is very, very, I love that you're doing that.
Absolutely. And so it's like, so not only are we, you know, there's a different standard for the white girl who weighs 110 pounds versus the black girl who weighs 150 pounds or 160 pounds, right? There's also, even if the white girls are getting, and some of them are suspended for wearing crop tops and short skirt. We're not saying it never happens. It doesn't happen to them at the same rate.
Right.
But if it did happen to them at the same rate, suspending and punishing girls for their dress code,
further
for their clothing, which, by the way, New York City does not have a universal dress code. So
same
these things
Florida.
Are, you know, they're handled school by school, teacher by teacher, administrator by administrator, girl by girl. So when these things happen, you're sending a message to our girls that they're the ones responsible for making sure that they're not sexually harassed or
which
sexually assaulted, which is the same thing that they will learn again when they are adults, when it becomes, what were you drinking? Where were you? Who were you with? How late were
Why
you
were
out?
You
who
there?
Have you been having
Why
sex?
Were you there?
Did you have sex with him before? All of that. And so you're removing these girls from classroom time. Meanwhile, in New York City, you have 1.1 million students and one Title IX coordinator. One, and that position is vacant, by the way. But they have one person whose job is to pursue investigations of sexual assault, sexual violence, and harassment claims.
Wow.
So one for 1.1 million students. So you've got piles of cases that are
cases.
The school ends up, schools and districts end up settling. You know, girls end up leaving. Like, we're not confronting the sexual violence that takes place in our schools.
And we're not also, when it comes to these dress code violations, right now we just talked about girls. We didn't even touch non-binary students or our LGBTQ youth who are also struggling. And I think that the problem with this is policy. It's education. Because I am someone who fights for sex ed mandate K through 12, medically accurate, culturally competent, and inclusive. The problem is, although New York City is a sex ed mandate, it is a soft mandate, and they do not have enough qualified teachers who have been trained in the work to do the work. And I am a firm believer, you start educating a young person to body autonomy. And, you know, I do an activity called Circles of Touch, which uses colors and shapes to help young people, 4, 5, 6, understand who's in this circle, who's in this circle, who can give me high fives. We have to teach that from zero all the way up. So then by the time they get to high school, there is no questions. And in addition, we have to train educators. We have to train administration. Because if the leadership doesn't understand policy, doesn't understand cultural competency, these kinds of dress code violations will continue to perpetuate, right? So it can't. And then in addition to that, parents, I know you guys, we want sex ed to start in the home, but some parents don't know how to even start. So we need more resources to help parents. Like, adult parenting sex ed classes are needed. We need to seek people out who can facilitate those conversations. And being a woman of color, I know there are them out there, but it seems like far too often we take the advice of people that don't necessarily look like us in this space. I love Dr. Ruth. I love Dr. Drew. But a part of why I got into this was I was like, how do they know what it's like to be black and deal with all these things? Because that is a large part of what plays into our holistic sexuality.
So I like the conversation where it's shifting now because it's where I wanted to take it. We talked about the adults in this documentary and the accomplices. The bystanders, the not only the parents, but the entourage, the friends, family members. So I guess I want to now shift the latter part of this conversation now to how we hold each other accountable. We can't sit here and think that this is going to change because our children are going to know now what to do. This has to start with us now. We are all now generation XYZ, millennials. We're all here, baby boomers. It now has to be to where we hold the people around us accountable. So you were a part of this documentary. We both said, Bruce ain't
everybody
got a goddamn
lick
of shit.
Pretty
much everybody has to go to jail. But I wanted to talk to you and what your immediate thoughts were on the accountability of the adults that were around while this was happening.
I think they're all trash. I think every adult who was around and witnessed this was trash. Now, but the problem, there's so many problems that go into that. It gets into money and it gets into people not being able to
and
take
power.
Care of their families. Not even just power, though. Sometimes it's just survival. Because if you sat there and you looked at, what was her name? Not Javante. What was the background dancer's name?
Javante.
You look at her and like I said, I sat there and I said, all of you motherfuckers are complicit and all of y'all got to go to jail. But when I started doing math, I'm like, well, this girl, when she's talking about sneaking Aaliyah out and doing all this, and I know this is not specifically about the documentary.
Right.
But I'm like, when she's doing that, how old is she? She's 17, 16, 18 years
17,
old?
Yeah.
And Aaliyah's 14 years
18.
Old? Yeah. I had 17-year-old friends.
Right.
That's your peer.
Same.
So, but the adults. That raggedy-ass nigga who sat up there and said, I wanted to help her. But I saw the look in her eyes. But you motherfucking helped facilitate the paperwork and you helped put all of this into place. Mm-hmm. Not one of you stepped up and said, this shit is wrong.
But what you were saying with the money.
But the reason is because he was their meal tickets. That is not a justification. I think they're all trash. And that motherfucker Bruce and those purple ass eyes, he can stay there for the fuck ever.
Yeah,
like
I
that
agree.
Nigga
yeah.
can stay there forever. He don't need to be on the streets. We don't need another one on the street.
I'll say with what you're saying with money, and I feel like this is why a lot of us in the black households also deal with this. I grew up in a single parent household, and my mom also grew up with a stepdad. And when it came to what was happening with her, again, I didn't receive details, but her mom chose the dad. A lot of us as women will choose the provider. Yeah. And we do allow men into our households when we have children. And if they're bringing something to the table, we feel like we can't lose that, sometimes at the expense of our own children.
Yeah. Well, I think, again, this goes back to how sexuality touches every aspect of our life, because it comes down to black women not having equal pay for equal work.
There you go.
That is sexuality in the workplace. Mm-hmm. And this is what, again, I just want to reiterate to people, because when you really start to think about how sexuality bleeds into everything in your life, you might then wake up. You wonder why these people were selling people out. Just like you said, a single mom. Black women make less money, have less opportunity for upward mobility. They was just trying to make sure you had, like, her daughter had food.
Right.
But black people, too, and it goes into education. And you know, people talk about, I don't want to talk about slavery no more. It all goes back to it, though. And it goes back, it's all generational. All of these secrets and all of these things we don't want to talk about. And the fact that we don't have the money to take care of our families and do all of these things. And so we're willing to put up with fucked up shit and be nasty and savage-ass human beings because we just want to motherfucking pay our rent or what have you. Or these niggas are worse. Like, they're worse. Like, they wanted to be a part. They needed that.
I'm curious, during the documentary, were you able to be in the same room with any of these people? Or no. You weren't able to talk to any of them?
I was only present for my interview.
Okay.
But I am friends with Dream. And so we talked a bit throughout the process. So I had some insight and some...
So that would be, I would say, because I would want to know, after listening to these adults saying that they were witnessing, they were almost all a part of human trafficking, if you sit here and ask me. Every person that was a part of R. Kelly's entourage or team at that specific time, and even probably now, helped him get those
the
girls.
The police.
The police department warned him about the welfare checks.
Yeah.
I was just like, holy shit, this is a problem in the community. So this I want to call surviving society, because that's what the fuck we're doing. But with those people or with those individuals, where does it get to where we can be comfortable to sit here and confront our friends, our homies, our providers? Like, where is it? Where do we get there?
A conversation I had with a mutual friend of ours actually once about how do you step in when your homeboy is mistreating a woman? Right? And we weren't even talking about violence. We were talking about, I think, I can't remember if it started with infidelity or like rampant infidelity or if it was even just, maybe it was child neglect.
Okay.
Not seeing your child, not paying your child support, but being at the bar, being out with other women, just
like
kind of like the power of social death.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It was Dream mentioned last night, like, if women wouldn't fuck with you if they knew that you didn't take care of your child. If you were persona non grata, if you go in the bar and everybody's like, he don't take care of his kid, you can't get a phone number, you can't find set, you know what I mean? Would that change things? If you're homeboys, right? Because you don't really respect or listen to women. You'll find
another circle
of women, right? Maybe the women in your peers, in your circles, you know, like, okay, you're a podcaster, the podcast girls aren't fucking with me, but I can go to New Jersey or I can go elsewhere and find some women.
Right.
But let's talk about your friends. If you always step up and say, listen, what you're doing, be it your child, be it something that you've done physically or emotionally to your woman, if you're the one who's, you know, getting her, get her another drink, dog, get her another drink. And you're like, whoa, she's had a lot to drink already. What are you trying to do? You know, or making sure that this woman doesn't go with him. Like, if we could count on you all to do that, it would change so much. And I challenge that of the men who are bothered by feeling, you know, that we're painting black men in a bad light because we want to talk about sexual violence against black women and girls, which typically does happen at their hands, right? Mm-hmm. It didn't start at your hands in this country, but it ended it. It's in your hands now.
It's in your hands
you
now.
You are the ones that have the power to change that.
And what
right?
and what Michelle said was, while we're sitting here having this conversation and while you have your organizations, you are sitting here, you're a part of a lot of organizations and you help with education, it's not only us that can make this change. It is a lot of men. And the only thing that I sat here and thought of during the documentary, during conversations with male friends who sit here and either help their friends cheat, turn a side eye when they're abusing their girlfriends, all of these things, like Michelle, like you said, men, we need you to also step in and take part. And I like that challenge. So for any men who are listening right now and sat here and felt disgusted the same way we did at this documentary and genuinely want to make a change, something without starting a nonprofit or anything big can start as immediate as the niggas in your circle, your brothers, your uncles, anyone that you see is doing questionable that you don't agree with. Confront that person, confront that man, and ask him, why are you doing this? And I don't think it's right. And I think a lot of people wouldn't think it is right. And literally sit here and make them self-reflect. And if they don't want to change their ways, remove yourselves. A lot of these people, their narcissistic behaviors, their desire to be around other people, that idea that you said in the beginning, the manhood and to be the man, that demands respect from a lot of a lot of people.
Yeah.
And fellas, if you sit here and start removing your respect for others, they'll sit here and might do a little change.
I think that if we're gonna say that, people are going to come after me for this one. We often have to admit that women can be predators too.
Absolutely.
100%.
Yes. And women can be predators on men. And so we are not saying, man, you're the only bad person out there.
Not at all.
Because there are definitely some predator women out there. Yeah.
Oh, this molestation shit is not. It's not
chicken and egg.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? I had said earlier, if a boy is molested at 11 by an 18-year-old girl, and then we say, no, you weren't molested, you become a man, how can he then understand when he sexually assaults somebody if he was told, we're discrediting you? We, if we're going to believe survivors, we believe survivors. And that also means that sometimes we have to take a long, hard look in the mirror and ask ourselves, because, you know, in my own experience, I had to ask myself, what kind of derelict ass things did I do in college when I was like, oh, you know, maybe if I got him one more cup of Hennessy, he would give me that attention I want.
Or when we're not as likely to be predatory, but our propensity to be coercive.
Oh, yes.
So when a man says, I don't want to do this.
Yes, but baby.
And you're kissing on him, or you're putting, you know, his penis in your mouth. And we're not looking at this as a sexual assault. And we're not.
Yes.
And because the power dynamics
not
are different.
Yes, because
right?
they're stronger.
They're stronger. They don't have the same social, like what happens to you socially if the world hears your story.
Right.
If you reject me sexually versus me rejecting you sexually. And what could be the consequence? They're different, but that's still not okay.
Coercion is coercion.
And it's not about derailing the conversation about Black women and girls.
Nope.
It's about saying, like, the rape culture means that men are expected to be, while there's the notion that we are sexually available to them at all times, that they're supposed to be sexually ready for us at all times, that they have to want it. And if you don't want it, you're weak, or you're gay, there's something wrong with you, and so that we don't allow them to have a lack of desire or interest or fatigue or any number of reasons to not be looking for sex.
That's the issue that I have, because even I will say, I told you all, my mother, the sex thing, it was like she would speak about it, but it just wasn't in great detail.
Right.
But she did let us know how special your virginity is. She did let us know, like, you don't have to give yourself to anybody if you don't want to. And that stayed with me, because I was never eager to lose my virginity.
Right.
Like, I never felt pressured. I was like, no, nigga, get out of here. Like, I don't care what you say about me. I don't want to do it.
Right.
And I know a lot of us have had those pressures. Mm-hmm. I never felt that, and I appreciate my mom for teaching me that. However, that same special, that whole special feeling, your flower, your this and that, is not taught to boys. It's not taught to boys. That sexual experience about how it's supposed to be personal, it's supposed to be something between two people that you love, they're not taught that. It's not ingrained in them the way that it is into girls, and that's a problem.
I've always said I think we need to celebrate the first wet dream like we celebrate a period, because that is at the point at which their sperm or their gametes are mobile enough to swim up through the uterus into that fallopian tube and fertilize an egg. Life. Prior to that, they can't actually make a child. So it's the same exact experience. Well, it's, you know, similar experience of a period. And we celebrate periods, and we have these moon parties, and we then let women know the gravity and responsibility.
I'm so
That was Lilith Fairmont.
Yeah,
But you're right that we do still recognize it as an important step on this journey of womanhood, right? I think about the Blackish period episode, and again, like, she's got a Lilith Fair mom and a Lilith Fair
mom. Lilith Fair moms aren't bad.
I'm not at all.
Mom, but you know, like,
I had a half Lilith Fair daddy. He went to get a pet goose, and we were like, nigga, why? It's a long story.
But again, it's like that we don't see anything, and I'm kind of like, you know, I don't want my child to think of her virginity as a delicate flower to be protected. I want her to think about, because I discarded my virginity like an ill-fitting pair of shoes.
Same.
I was like, just get it out of the way. I barely remember the person, you know what I mean? Because I was curious about sex. I was ready to get started, and just the virginity felt like a weight to me. And even though I lost it at 15 and didn't start, I didn't become sexually active until 18. Mm-hmm. Like, I didn't like the pressure that people are like, who's going to be the first? Who's good enough?
Yeah, that's
who do I like enough? Like,
that
just felt like a weight to me.
But
there's still something to, like, when I talk to young people, because I do a bit of college speaking, we talk about sexual agency and consent and consent-based, that lack of consent-based education and how important that is for, you know, kids of all gender expressions and adults to learn or relearn that. You should be thinking about sex as something that is an act between two consenting people who are eager, you know, affirmative consent, right? Desire.
Happy consent.
Right? That I respect you. I am interested and invested in your pleasure. I want to share this experience with you, whether we're in a serious, committed relationship or in a casual sex experience. You know, and that's what's so radical about what you all do. Like, I hope I don't get emotional, but, like, I was the sex-positive feminist since I was a kid, right? Like, before I had the language to even describe it. Like, I remember when my friends were like, I don't think think I'm ever going to suck dick, like, ever. You know? Or, like, girl. I'm going to just suck. I don't know how they become Valley Girls because we're from the South Side. That's how silly they sound. It was probably like, I ain't sucking nobody dick, like, never.
That's how they said it.
Right. Or maybe, you know, I might suck like my husband's dick. And I just remember just feeling like, and I wasn't out there yet, but I just remember saying, I think it's going to happen sooner than that, you guys. Yeah. You know, like, it just seemed like this doesn't really sound, it just sounds like it's a part of sex to me, and we're all really curious and interested in receiving oral sex, so just stands to reason that at some point we're good. This is going to be a trade-off at the very least.
Or it should be. Mm-hmm.
You know, or it should be, right? And that's something I always say, like, don't go down on somebody. Wouldn't go down on you. I don't care if you're, you know, 18, 28, 38, if they wouldn't do it to you, unless you are like, I don't desire it like that, or I don't want that tonight, then you're not sleeping with somebody who respects your sexual pleasure. But we're not telling, you know, for boys, it's just kind of taken for granted that they're going to, because they're likely to ejaculate, they will enjoy this experience. They don't have to think about whether the girl...
It's not a broken cherry or what have you.
Yeah. Right. Oh, God, the
hymen. Right, the high,
the hymen.
But I mean, even... mythical thing, like unicorns.
Even with what you were saying, though, like you losing your virginity at 15, I lost mine at 16. It was... It's also a thing to where when you lose it at those ages, older adults... your peers, other men, the reference to you being fast, you being a hoe, you being, I will sit here and go back to me being 28 now, the things that I know now and how I feel now and how I respond now to sex, to partners, to all of that is completely a 180 from what I was doing at fucking 16 to say 21, honestly.
Yeah. Oh, girl.
Like, holy shit. So the fact that we put these mature adult responsibilities even on these young, still children. I was fucking as a child. I don't give a fuck what you, like, I was fucking as a child. And knowing now with the podcast and with the research and with friends like you and having conversations like this with you two, I know now, I can look back, I was fucking pedophiles. I was or I was fucking the other word you said.
Yeah.
It's a weird.
Look at your name. I had to look it up.
She
again.
Was having
ephebophilia.
That I was dealing with men who were
like underage girls.
Yeah,
not pre-pubescent.
Yes, bitch, you know. And so, like, to sit here and have the platform that I do, that's why I thought this conversation was so important, because we do sit here and say, well, if you've been fucking since you was 10 or 11 or 12, you get it. And it's like everything that I did probably before 24. Honestly.
Before 25, when your prefrontal cortex develops.
What I find very interesting about that, nerdy point, you guys are saying 24, 25, your brain is not fully formed,
that's what
we
those,
now know, until about 25, 26. That prefrontal cortex is not fully formed. So, you know, I always tell when I'm doing lectures or college tours or classroom work, I'm like, listen, y'all out here just bumping uglies.
That's
the sex you having right now ain't nowhere near how it's going to be popping over later.
No clue.
When you have a job.
Yeah.
When you've discovered who you are as a person.
Yeah.
When you finish college. And I'm not telling you, shame on you for doing it. Mm-hmm. You got to hit your head against the wall a couple times in high school. But trust me, y'all ain't need to be doing it that much. Y'all don't need to collect so many notches on your belt. You don't need so many numbers. Although, I lost my number in 1998.
If my number walked up to me and shot me on Fifth Avenue, I wouldn't know who it was.
If I had to give you the right number...
Listen,
to save my life, bitch,
I told
you,
did. The girl
dead.
Told y'all on the internet the number is four. She said the number is four. She said go up or down. If you fuck two niggas named Ryan, you fuck one nigga named Ryan.
So here's
the number is four.
So you know what? Because people don't believe that one hand, I like to say nine, because you're still on two hands.
I don't even care.
Or you do the math. That's like,
I know.
You're
it's
telling
so
me you slept with one person a year.
It's
for
so
like,
stupid.
If you really do the math.
If you do the math.
I'm a grown woman. I am past 35, looking a whole hell of a lot closer to 40 than 30, if you know what I'm saying. And if I lost my virginity, at 15, bitch, we looking at almost 20 years of
the fucking.
Right. Yeah. So we clearly know.
Right.
Okay, my number's 20.
Right.
We'll go with that.
There you go.
Sure.
There you go.
Right. Wait, are we only talking men?
Right.
Hello.
Yeah, hello. There's that
then
too.
The number is like
I
double.
Don't know.
Oh, I got to add women.
How about that? 24. There you go.
So I want to circle this back. I want to discuss more of the general aspects that relate to this. We talked about accountability. We did talk about us as children, but I wanted to get into a lot of men were questioning why these women, why these victims chose to go on Lifetime and share their story in that case instead of taking this man to court, instead of letting the court system find him guilty. And as you guys see, I believe this was in part 3 and 4, we saw that the court system has already failed us once. Absolutely. With just this predator.
Twice, Florida and Chicago.
One of the tweets that I saw today that resonated with all of y'all and even the parents on this last part that was saying, well, he wasn't found guilty. Mm-hmm. Oh. I saw a tweet today that said, George Zimmerman wasn't found guilty.
Yeah.
Would you let your black ass son hang around George Zimmerman?
No.
So for these parents and for all of these people to sit here and try to use the court system to justify his innocence, it's fucking disgusting.
And a lot of these same people that would use the court system to justify R. Kelly's innocence would look at Bill Cosby being behind jail as a behind bars as a travesty because the court system is out to get black men.
Well, right.
So which one is it?
But then those are also the same parents who will not allow their students to sign up for a fifth grade sex ed class.
Absolutely.
Because you know what? My child don't need to know that. I'm going to teach them when they're ready. I got into an argument on Thursday with a dude at a bar about this. He was like, I don't like how you support Amber Rose. She's this, that, and the other. I was like, bro, she's talking about women equal sexuality.
Right.
I don't need to teach my son that. Oh, Lord. Oh, here
so what
we
you
go.
Teaching?
13
what
years old,
them?
Never had a conversation with him about sex. 13-year-old boy. That's a problem.
That is a
huge
problem.
Oh,
they're fucking early.
Like, they're,
it's a huge
people
problem.
Don't understand that porn... First, onset of porn is 9 here in the U.S. on average when you think about cell phones. So you're mad at the parents. He wasn't found guilty. Like, why does they have to be found guilty?
I hate that so many of those parents.
Not to mention, out of sexual assault, like when it comes to sexual assault, only about 9 of every 1,000 cases see a district attorney's desk.
Oh, wow.
One, that doesn't even mean somebody gonna be found guilty. You've had 9,000 reports and only 9 get to see a district attorney, a prosecutor's desk? Oh, but them other...
That doesn't even mean there's a trial.
Hello,
right.
That's what
right,
I'm saying.
Right.
So how many actually get found guilty? Probably less than 1.
Listen, there are people who are found guilty within the households by other people in the household.
And nobody says nothing.
And people still sweep it under the rug, or they still excuse it, or they still say, oh, well, you know, we don't want to send them to jail, or we don't want to keep doing this,
Black
that, or the third.
Black men are already on the down, down.
Again, can I tell you one of the saddest stories I've ever heard? I was at a camp, like a week-long camp for, it was like activists, survivors of violence. Many of them were relatives of people who'd been killed by police. It was like a healing space. The Kimberly Crenshaw, it was the architect of intersectionality had put together. Mm-hmm. And I was teaching a writing class. It's a young Muslim sister who tells a story about when she lived in Philadelphia. She wears a head covering, so they're identifiably Muslim family. And post 9/11, how things changed. Even though they were obviously African-American Muslims, but they've got the last name, say Muhammad, you know, they're wearing their religious garb. I think the men in her family may also wear it, you know, so now they're being profiled, they're being called terrorists, they're dealing with these other things. At the same time, her older brother is sexually molesting her. And she, at a very young age, I want to say 10, 11, 12, is aware that she's grappling with wanting to go to her family and ask for help, but also this fear that the police would kill her brother, that she carried this weight for years.
That's
and that so many of us, you know, be it a date rape, be it somebody that we've known for a long time, be it, you know, even someone on the street. Just this idea that involving the system beyond you might not believe me, you know, you might not take me seriously because I'm a Black woman, that I feel responsible for my assailant.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, when I was sexually assaulted, I was raped when I was 21, right before I moved to New York. I was literally in the process. I was supposed to move to New York 2 days after it happened. I ended up staying. I was living right outside of D.C. I just finished college. I ended up staying out there an extra week to kind of get my head together and stuff. And I lied to the police and said that he was white for two reasons. One, I was like, I have to get the, I was afraid that they would keep me there. One, I was like, why do I even think they're going to like actually investigate this? Like, but I was afraid. I was like, what if I have to stay? I don't want to do a trial. I have to get out of here. Mm-hmm. So I lied about the race. But the other thing was, I was like, I don't believe y'all are going to take
this
seriously.
He was actually what?
He was Black.
Okay.
But, and it was a stranger. But I also, and it was a robbery, but like, I also feared that, like, if they do go out there looking, they're just going to start. One, I can't identify him. You know, like he had on a mat. It was like a traditional from TV, the type of thing that's supposed to be cut and dry. Like, this is exactly as bad as it looked. I should get all the sympathy. There's no gray area. And still was not treated that way by police, you know, officers and detectives, and still was treated as if it was insignificant, and didn't get a phone call from the rape crisis folks till like 3 months later. Like, we went to check on you. I was like, you know, do you want to come in for counseling? I'm like, I moved. I can't, I'm not in Maryland anymore. Like, I couldn't come if I wanted to. But I also thought about, like, so they're going to stop some arbitrary black dudes? Like, I'm going to have to go participate in this process of them stopping arbitrary black guys? I just want to get out of here. And if I had to do it all over again, I would have given an accurate description, but I was really just like, I just want to get out of here. I just want to move. I want to move on.
It's crazy that you bring that up. I shared that I was molested on a train up here. It was rush hour, and I was trying to put my purse behind me because, you know, you bump into people, the train, you can't move. The doors opened at an express stop, and his dick was fully out of his pants. He had been rubbing his dick on me for the 5 or 6 minutes that we were on the train, and I froze and started crying. And what you're saying, what made me even more mad was that I looked at him and he was a black man. And of all the things to think, I wished he was everything but a black man. Because I didn't want to have the hate of a black man, because that's all I deal with. That's all I have sex with. That's, my dad is black. A lot of the men in my family are black. And I had just been physically assaulted. I froze, couldn't even do all the things I said I would do if I ever was sexually assaulted. I froze and then just started crying and went home. And literally, that was the thought that came to my head, was fuck, this was a black man. And I was pissed. It was a stranger, but the fact that it was a black man. Yeah. And I want to bring another story to this. My uncle actually just got deported. This was recent. In my family, we came to find out that he was molesting my cousin since she was a child. And the only reason she came forward... His daughter. The only reason she came forward was because she got pregnant with a girl. And the fear of him doing that to her daughter was the only reason why she told our whole family. And it was mixed feelings, because my dad, it was my dad's brother, he was upset that now his brother had to be deported, but then, so he was upset at that, but then also made sure that my uncle had never touched me or my sisters, which he didn't. But to know that this was happening our entire childhood, nobody knew, and the only reason she thought to come out was, as an adult, she was having a girl and didn't want it to happen to her daughter. And so again, with it happening in the family, with me not wanting to see black men act this way, like, I do want more for us. And it is a lot of the times black men hurting us as black women. Yeah. And so it's going to be a conversation for us to make a change, and however we can, with your education, with your nonprofits and your foundations, and then with you as a mother, with you bringing the education that you are to your daughter, to hopefully spew that into generations to come. But again, we're going to need the black men on this just as much, and not for you, like I see on Twitter and Instagram, for you guys to keep pointing the fingers back to us.
You're gonna, or have a white man, or
the white man,
and stop,
we love blaming the white man.
Get involved.
Yes,
right.
Come to a class. Talk, start up a parent brunch with your homies, where you start having these, like, have a dude's night, get some cognac, and have some hard conversations with the homies.
Yeah. Because a lot of us women do.
Because that's the thing, you have to unpack first, and through that unpacking and through conversation and dialogue, we will come to solution together. And yes, black men are hurting black women, and white men are hurting white women, and Muslim men are hurting, and it's men are hurting women.
Yes, of course.
And when we talk about black men specifically, it's because, one, we have to acknowledge that, like, men, when people are hurt by people that look like them, you know, you're getting robbed by a white guy if you're a white guy, you're getting, you know, harmed by a white man if you're a white woman. But when we talk about black men, it's because, one, not only are the ones doing it to us, but that you know, when white people talk about sexual assault, they don't talk about white men have to stop hurting white women. They talk about men hurting women.
They don't.
Right? Mm-hmm. One, because they see themselves as the default to humanity, you know, and their issues are everyone's issues.
Yes.
You know, and also their experiences with people of color and sexual assault, how that enters, you know, to them are the same, right? Mm-hmm. But also for us, it's like, when we say we need to talk about black men, it's because we know that conversation has to be different, because we're taking into account Emmett Till. Yep. We're taking into account Trayvon Martin being profiled and hunted down and murdered for the possibility that he could be there to do harm to a white woman or girl, right? Like we understand all of this, you know, and not everybody who wants to do that work understands it. When we talk about people going a little bit too far or being a little bit too soft, like there's just so much nuance and so much history that you have to take into account. And so I'm not angry at the discomfort that black men feel at the beginning of the Bill Cosby or R. Kelly sagas.
Of course.
What I'm upset with is now that you've had years to realize that those are not the average black man. They're not even the average black male predator.
Right.
Because not only has the power and the money and the influence that they have has allowed them to create
the
these ecosystems of abuse, right? Ecosystems, rather. But also the volume.
Yep.
Right, the volume of accusers, the volume of victims is so profound that we can have a different conversation about Nate Parker, for sure, right? Mm-hmm. But if you're having the conversation and the lack of affirmative consent-based sexual education, you know, and that's not to absolve him of any guilt, but it's a different conversation than somebody who has 60, than somebody accuser, somebody who has, you know, count with R. Kelly, is the number is just countless, right? And we know how many have come forward, and it's just, I'd like to do that work without being a re-traumatized or berated and abused by our men, and it hurts. And I'm willing, but I'm also like, I can take it. You know, I'm like, I'd rather, like when I was talking about the documentary online, I speak to the victims online, but I don't tag them in things. But I'd rather don't go at Geronda Pace. Come for me.
Of course.
Right.
You want to call me a black man hating bitch? You want to say I have an agenda? You want to say we're trying to, like, let me hold that. You know, don't foist that upon these people who are taken advantage of by this man from such a young age.
And if you're listening to this and you're wondering why we keep, you know, maybe singling out black men or black women or black girls, I want to say that it has been probably a consensus, a full narrative, that if these victims were white, that R. Kelly would have been tried differently. And a lot of times, again, and I don't want to say that maybe white victims have more of a voice, but in society, in the court system, I remember one of the jurors sat there and said, I didn't believe the women because of how they dressed, how they talked, and what they looked like.
That
was disgusting. But he was on, he was one of the jurors.
It was disgusting.
But he spoke for a large population
of the people.
Yes. And so I do want to sit here and say that that's why we are singling out black women and black men, because I think, as we know, we do as oppressors, it's sickening that we oppress our own in homophobia, in women, in gender roles, and all of that. And I just want better for our community, more so than anything.
I think that we're talking about black men.
Yeah.
Because we're black women.
Yeah.
Like, we go to bat for y'all.
I can't talk about
white
men. And I be fucking y'all.
We don't understand.
I've never had sex with a white man.
I
don't date white men. I don't know about white men. So I can't talk about white men. My trauma is not at the hands of white men.
I don't want any of the black men listening. No, this isn't a call.
If any of us produce a male child, we're going to have black men.
Black men. And so I want you guys to know that that's why this narrative has taken place the way it has. But we are about to wrap up. I want all of you guys to follow everyone. We're going to go ahead and let you all know what we have coming up, where you can find us. And if you would like maybe a part two of this conversation, let me know and let us know what other topics you would like. Going into 2019, I'm about to have a nice little vision boarding party, but I would absolutely love maybe somehow to set up a panel or a group conversation to have women come and talk to us, and men. I'm sorry. I would love men to come.
So
and
nice.
We need men in the room, but I would love to maybe set something up between the four of us, maybe any other people that you know are looking to talk
cis,
to this.
Hetero men, y'all need to come out
there you go.
And
we
open
you.
Your goddamn mouths and emotions.
There you
and
go.
It says, I will help facilitate it. I will
that
help
would be
get
amazing.
You all a vent. Like, we can help them get, like, yes, I would love to do something with you all, you know, in a mixed gender group or an all women group again.
Absolutely.
But yes, creating spaces for men to talk to men about what's going on and to listen to women in an environment where they are going to actually listen to us.
Yes.
We can facilitate. We will.
I would love that. New York is the place to do it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it's not a call out.
No.
It's a call in.
Call in.
Mm-hmm. And we're calling you in. We love you. I do want to give a shout out. There is a really great program called Black Boy Rise. Mm-hmm. Look it up. It's for black men and black boys, and they explore sexuality and toxic masculinity.
Oh, wow.
Yes. And that is a specialization. Lou is amazing. He does restorative justice work. We've worked together in a space of sexuality.
That's awesome.
I would love to bring him here. Again, it's Black Boy Rise. But again, we've said a lot of things, but like Mandy said, I want to say we need cisgendered black men badly.
Yeah.
And I'm just going to say, please find me out. Oh, and most importantly, I do want to give one critique about the R. Kelly thing. I was really disappointed. I'm going to say it.
Yeah.
At the very end, they had a great opportunity to kind of shift the discussion off R. Kelly to intimate partner violence, because that's really what it was about. Human trafficking, intimate partner violence. We've talked about that today. And they did not share a hotline number. So
we wanted to share
a hotline number.
And also, I'm going to make sure in the edits, if we can, put the number at the bottom of the screen for the entire episode.
And also, Girls for Gender Equity, we worked with Lifetime and Values Partnerships, which is an organization that was doing social engagement for the documentary. And we created a toolkit, a viewer's guide.
Oh,
so
there are
discussion questions that you can use with your friends, with young people. There's, you know, information for National Sexual Assault Telephone Hotline, as well as organizations that work specifically with victims of child sexual assault.
Great.
Ways to get involved with the fight to mute R. Kelly, organizations that are doing this work with black women and girls, period. So the resources are there.
Yeah,
please let me know that.
And I'm excited. Again, for 2019, Horrible Decisions is looking to do a lot. As you guys know, last year we partnered with Survive to Thrive, which is an organization based out here in New York, where they actually help domestic violence victims get back on their feet. So they help with dental care, they help with resumes, they help with help finding you jobs, and basically just getting you back into society as a whole and not as a battered victim. Also, for our Houston stop for the Horrible Decisions Tour, we are partnering with Flow Code, which is actually a nonprofit organization that helps underdeserved communities with helping them get menstrual products. So women who, like myself, may not, you know, have been very, very keen on letting their parents know that they were on their period. And even just having the products. As an adult, bitch, tampons are expensive.
Sure.
And so we're partnering with them for our Houston stop. If you are coming to our show in Houston, that will be on April the 20th. We will have Flow Code in the building. So please bring tampons, pads, anything that you feel to donate, and they will also be accepting cash donations. If you guys want to know more of the Horrible Decisions Tour stops, I will put it in the description here. I don't want to plug much more. Do you have anything else going on or anything in the works for 2019?
You guys can continue to check out Getting Grown, Jaden XD. We have some projects coming up. I have a cooking show that'll be coming out. But I just wanted to finalize. Y'all can go look at my social media.
Yeah.
It's fine. I want people to get therapy.
Yes.
I think that's so key.
I like that, yes.
This generational issue with sexual conversation and trauma and so forth, like, it goes back so far, and I really want us to start. These hotlines are wonderful, and we need to talk to people, but you need to talk to a therapist. And we need to start addressing these issues so that we can break this cycle somewhere, so we're not passing this on to our nieces and our children and our play nieces and whoever. Like, we need to have these hard conversations, and we need to start with having them about ourselves.
I like that. So we'll work again 2019. The conversation will continue to go. This is just the start of it. You did a great job introducing it, because this is definitely all something that needs to be discussed with, I think, all of our platforms. We definitely are trying to make change. We're starting conversations. You guys are going out and doing the fucking grunt of the work with actually being face to face with not only victims, but teaching people. And I appreciate all of you for sitting here with me and having this conversation. I will go ahead and we'll tie all of our social media accounts if you guys want to reach out to any of us with DMs. And again, maybe if you have a venue in New York, again, this is something we definitely want to bring a large volume of people to, where we can have this conversation, to where they can go. And again, we're here to plant the seed. So I want to thank you guys all for joining us. We hope that we stemmed some good conversation and ones that you can take back to your friends. Is there anything else that you guys want to leave off with? Y'all are good? Y'all are here? All right. Well, it's been good. It's been great. I hope all of you guys have a wonderful 2019. And again, the conversation starts here. The seeds are planted, and it's up to us to help this thing grow. So, bye.
Bye.